Strange. Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks. Written and read by Richard Strange. Episode 18. With the formalities of the Arista contract completed, I received the cheque for the first instalment of the advance. That night, Reenie and I enjoyed a good celebratory dinner with Brian Clark at his home in Notting Hill. The other guests included the art consultant Anthony Fawcett, advertising tycoon Frank Lowe, and Marie Helvin, the model. It was the first time I'd really met Marie, a stunning Hawaiian girl who was married to David Bailey. She was radiant with the most extraordinarily translucent skin and a delightfully relaxed charm. Fawcett had worked for John Lennon at one stage and was now a sort of PR guy, as far as I could comprehend. After an indecently short time on Michelle's books, I was actually offered my first part in a film. It was the first audition I'd ever been to, and when Michelle sent me to a small office in Soho to meet Mike Hodges and Mel Smith, I thought it was just too absurd and too easy. They were casting for a film entitled Morons from Outer Space, a dreadful film, as it turned out. Indeed, one of the all-time worst, but Hodges was a director with a very good reputation. He had directed the gritty 1971 British thriller Get Carter, one of Michael Caine's three halfway decent movies, and one of the best British films of the late 20th century. Mel was best known for his TV comedies, first with Not the 9 o'clock News and later with Alas, Smith and Jones. There's a long and regrettable tradition of British TV stars attempting to make the transition to the big screen and not managing to pull it off. The remainder racks in any video store bear appalling testimony to this fact. I felt that Morons from Outer Space would be no exception, but I accepted a small part in it as a first foot on the acting ladder. Soon afterwards, I did an episode of a spoof cop show called Dempsey and Makepeace and a commercial for something or other, and I was on my way. It was just as well that some money was coming in, because after a court appearance on the 25th of April, we were served with a 28-day notice to quit Babington Road in Streatham. The Normandales had succeeded in getting a court order, despite a stunning courtroom performance of heart-rending pathos by myself. Our situation was desperate because we really had nowhere to go, and anyone who's lived in London knows that 28 days is not a long time to find affordable accommodation for a family. I'd also recently heard from Edgar Lee Hall, Millfield Prep School, that Gino had not done sufficiently well in the exam to be offered a scholarship, but they would be prepared to give him a place as a fee payer. As boarding fees at Edgar Lee Hall were somewhere in the region of £4,000, it was out of the question. We entered him for a scholarship at the other school, Northbourne Park, near Deal in Kent. It was an idyllic setting, a rambling Edwardian country house in its own woodland, once owned by Joyce Grenfell's family, run in a slightly shambolic but caring way by a staff who seemed to be a throwback to the days of Alan Bennett's 40 Years On. The enterprise was watched over by the patrician eye of Lord Northbourne, a man I later found to be genuinely decent and enlightened, who lived nearby. Gino sat the exam, and we were both surprised and delighted when he was offered a scholarship with a place at the school for the term commencing in September. We explained to Gino what was involved with boarding, how he'd be living away from home with all the other children, and that we would frequently visit, and he would come home for holidays, and that our time together would be all the more special. But it was heartbreaking for us all, but especially for him. He said he would like to try it. We promised him that if he became miserable, we'd bring him back home to London, I'd find a local school for him. Neither Reenie nor I had any experience with private schools, and with the English class system so much part of the English education system, we agonised about what was the right thing to do. I still believe it was the right decision at the time. The fact that Gino even now visits the school when he is passing that way suggests that his time there was happy. As our date for eviction from Babington Road got ever closer, I was writing letters to every housing association in London trying to find one that could offer us a flat. Eventually my persistence paid off, and a Catholic association, no, I'm not, offered us a three-bedroom flat in Herne Hill near Brixton, available immediately at an affordable rent. The lady who lived downstairs was a little difficult, they explained, but apart from that, it was fine. We moved in and Gino finished the remainder of his last term at his old school without any further upheaval. Reenie and I painted up the new flat with some help from Mick Jones from the event group and Reenie's brother Dave, and we felt that despite all the dramas, we'd landed on our feet. Jim Telford and I went into Scorpio Studios beneath the Euston Tower in London to begin work on the first Engine Room single, Wild Times. I'd chosen Scorpio because the previous year I'd produced the Way of the West hit single, Don't Say That's Just for White Boys There, and I decided to use the same engineer who worked with me, the American boffin Dennis Weinrich. The reason I went to that particular studio in the first place was because Scott Walker had recorded his epic song The Electrician there with Dennis as engineer. The performance by Scott on that enigmatic ballad has always been one of my favourites. When I asked him about that session, Dennis told me, "We'd already recorded the entire backing track and it had taken forever to get it to the level of performance that Scott required. One morning, he arrived at the studio and announced that he would record the lead vocal in one take at 1:15 that afternoon. He said he would eat a whole roast chicken just prior to singing. We ordered the chicken. It arrived at 1:15. Scott ate the chicken and lay down on his back on top of the grand piano. I arranged two microphones above him where he lay, and at 1:15 he recorded the lead vocals straight through, faultlessly, in one take. It was awesome. He's drilling through the spirit to sanctus tonight. Through the dark hip falls, screaming, "Are you my boss? Kill me and kill me and kill me." If I check the handle, you'll die in your dreams. If I check the handle, check the handle, you'll thrill me and thrill me and thrill me. I can't pretend there were any such exotic arrangements for the recording of Wild Times, but the first couple of days went well. Gradually, though, we started to lose the essential poignancy of the song. We ended up with a half a dozen long and short mixes, but nothing really excited us. We told Arista that we weren't happy with the finished record, but they listened to it and convinced us that it was fine, even though we knew it wasn't quite right. Record companies are sometimes in a wretched position with bands, as the recording process can sometimes be a case of throwing good money after band, trying to capture a certain atmosphere or performance on a record. Max, our manager, was a lovely guy, but never quite tough enough when it came to a difference of opinion with the record company. He was just too nice. Consequently, he was steamrolled. With a substandard recording, we'd not got off to the best of starts with Arista. I had a lot of ideas about the video I wanted to make for the song. I wanted to shoot it at Marchmont, the McEwan's house on the borders. And I started to make plans. Arista told me to wait and see how the reviews were and the radio plays before they committed themselves to a video. I could understand their point. It cost upwards of £20,000 to make even a simple video of sufficient technical quality to get it onto TV. But in the mid-80s, promotional videos were an absolutely essential part of the marketing and promotion of any record release. The reviews and radio plays were okay, but no more than that, and the video never got made. I was called to do my 2 days filming on Morons from Outer Space early in July. Morons was a unhappy cross between a sci-fi spoof and a satire on the pop business, and the mainly British cast starred Mel Smith, Griff Rhys-Jones and Jimmy Nail. It was naff in every detail, but I found the experience of working on it fascinating. On my first morning on set, I went to hair and makeup, got into costume, went to my dressing room, and got my first taste of the realities of filmmaking. The realities are that a film typically takes, say, 12 weeks to shoot, and typically lasts for 2 hours on screen. It doesn't take a genius to work out that this means they shoot 10 minutes screen time a week. An actor will, however, be on set for maybe 12 hours a day, sometimes longer, sometimes less. So what happens for the 10 out of 12 hours when an actor is on call but not actually in front of the camera? He waits. In his too small dressing room, alone or with others, he waits. He waits for the knock on the door of a young third assistant to the director, the same youth who brings him his first bacon sandwich and cup of rancid coffee at 5 a.m. as he arrives, bleary-eyed on set. The same youth who tells him at 1 o'clock that he can have lunch and apologise that he hasn't done a single shot yet. The same youth who will rouse him from his mid-afternoon torpor with, "They're ready for you on set," and escort him to the brightly lit, bustling studio to meet the director for the first time. And while they're lighting the set for the scene he's about to shoot, the director will ask, "Have you had a look at the script? Shall we run the lines?" He will then meet whichever other actors he's doing the scene with, sometimes for the first time, sometimes not, and attempt to act under the watchful eye of the director. Only half watchful, actually, because the director is constantly being bombarded with questions about where he wants the light to be, where the tracking for the camera dolly should be laid, and which wig he prefers on the actress, the blonde or the brunette. When the director does have a minute to talk to the actors, he will give a thumbnail sketch of the way he sees a scene being played, the way the lines are to be delivered, the movement within a scene, the entrances and exits of the players, the use of props or special effects. When you're playing a small part, as I was in Morons, you'll quite often only see the pages of the script that your lines appear on. You'll have no overall idea of what the film is actually about. And that can be quite disorientating, especially when the crew and the principal characters do know what's going on and have already built up a camaraderie over the preceding weeks. You feel very much like an outsider on every level. Given all this, it was a nice gesture when Mel Smith knocked on my door to introduce himself on my first day at the studio. I was reading The Times and checking my Times bingo card. The Times was running a competition based on the daily movement of share prices on the London Stock Exchange. You had a blue and white plastic card the size of a credit card with a dozen or so numbers printed on it that corresponded to a dozen different listed companies. You had to match the total gains or losses of your 12 shares with the total printed in the newspaper each day. If you matched it, you won £1,000 or something like that. When Mel came in and saw me, he was amused because he and Griff Rhys-Jones had been responsible for the TV ad campaign for that promotion. As he sucked on a huge cigar at 7 a.m, he told me that the chances of winning were minuscule, a fact I'd already deduced, but that the cards were not altogether useless. And with that, he took a large mirror from the wall and put the card to much better use. We quickly got chatting and he started to enthuse about the merits of different forms of gambling. His preference was for horse racing. He announced conspiratorially, "I'll see if we can make ourselves some money today. I'll just have to make a couple of calls." And with that, he left my dressing room. 10 minutes later, he returned. "Pity," he announced cryptically, "none of the GGs are trying today." In my naivety, I was surprised to learn that such information could be gleaned from a couple of phone calls to stable lads and trainers. It was an eye-opener for someone with only a passing acquaintance with the sport of kings. Later that day, I shot my first scene as a film actor. It was not a particularly memorable debut, but I was happy just to get through it without any major embarrassment. I don't remember whether my scenes even survived the director's cut. I'd certainly enjoyed the day, though, in a perverse sort of way, and I felt that I'd acquitted myself sufficiently well to seriously think about taking the acting side of my career further. At the end of the summer, it was time for Gino to start at Northbourne. The cost of buying all the component parts of the school uniform, the various bits of games kit, a musical instrument, new luggage to carry everything in, were pretty well ruinous, but we knew that the culture shock for Gino from going to Lambeth Inner City State School to a home county's prep school was going to be big enough without lumbering him with a shabby suitcase full of inappropriate clothing. At that age, more than any other, a kid just wants to be invisible. As I hadn't yet learned to drive, we all went down on the train to the nearest station and then got a cab to the school. It was a beautiful late summer's day with golden light pouring through the trees and the warm fragrance of the English countryside hanging in the air. At the school, it was all bustle and frenetic activity. Large cars were crunching up the gravel driveway and disgorging apple-faced children at the school's door. Those veterans who were returning after a school holiday had the luxury of familiarity. To Gino and the other first-timers, all was new and bewildering. He was immensely brave, refusing to betray any sadness or reproach, and when he was whisked off by a kindly matron, it was Rini and me who were the closest to tears. We climbed back into our waiting taxi, stunned into silence and biting our lips, then driven back to the station to wait for our train back to a silent, empty house. We were advised not to call for the first few days, as the settling-in period would be that much more painful if tearful parents talked to tearful children about the agonies of separation. For the next few weeks, we grasped what little comfort we could from snatched telephone conversations with him and weekly letters that we anticipated and devoured many times over with morning coffee, scavenging what crumbs of consolation we could from them. We missed him appallingly and were riddled with guilt. Little by little, though, he settled in and we visited him as often as we could, and we lived for the times when he came home at weekends or half terms or school holidays. We would make the 6-hour round trip just for the chance of seeing him play an hour-long football match, or possibly to share a glass of warm orange juice with him at half time, or to crane our necks in order to catch a glimpse of him as he sang in the school choir. As the summer ended and leaves fell, Jim and I began recording session for Going Gone, the first Engine Room album, and our follow-up single. We'd found a new producer with whom we got on incredibly well, and we were looking forward to the sessions enormously. The producer, Dave Allen, who'd produced the latest records by The Cure and the Sisters of Mercy, and had engineered the Human League's recent hits. In addition to being a highly competent engineer and producer, Dave was a great guy to be with. We began the sessions at Tony Visconti's Soho studio, Good Earth, where Bowie often recorded. Dave got fabulous big meaty sounds onto tape and understood perfectly the sort of album we wanted to make. We wanted to make a record that was eclectic, using elements of ethnic music, electronics, samples and pure pop, a record that combined the high and low technologies. Jim recorded the basic tracks with synths and drum machines, and then we added broad washes of colour as we progressed. Jim was pretty efficient with his writing and had a good feel for a muscular bass line and a solid beat. My skill was for lyrics and melodies, and we combined well together. We used the Mighty Bolts for a lot of the guitar parts, Winthrop for saxes, Rini and Julie Hepburn for lead vocals, plus the three black divas known collectively as Aphrodisiac. And for brass parts, we enlisted a section called the Kick Horns. We went for a Middle Eastern feel on the opening track, Damascus, using samples of muezzins and Arab singers, and real Arab violins and percussion. It was a song that sought to conjure up the steamy claustrophobia of a Middle Eastern town after dark.
Run, run, run in the heat. We will tear down the walls.
We'd also written a song called Your Kiss is a Weapon, which was very light and catchy, and we decided to go for that as a single. Dave did a great job of making a mid-80s pop record out of that song, with drum machines, synths and big brass parts. And it sounded like it had as much chance as anything else around as a single. Arista were pretty taken by it too, and it was agreed that it would be our next single, to be released with a launch party for the band in February. Everyone was very positive and enthusiastic. When I played Morrison the track in Hyde Park Place, he sucked on his cigar, grinned his toothy grin, and came up and put his arm round me. "My son," he said, exhaling a Hiroshima-like mushroom cloud of Monte Cristo smoke, "you have fucking cracked it. This song is a smash." By little, over the next 9 turbulent months, we assembled that album, fitting in with Dave's availability around his other commitments and piecing together a record of which I was really proud. The school Christmas holidays arrived and Gino came home. 8 years old is a great age for a child, but he was special. He was great company, always truthful and never whinged. We spent Christmas at our new home with a tree and decorations and all the trimmings, and friends and relations came and visited. It was idyllic, or almost. All Reenie saw was the spectre of Sophie everywhere, like the ghost of Christmases to come.
Your kiss is a weapon.